The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued. Cassette 5, Side 1.
That is why, when the Emperor Mikhail informed us at the Lubyanka about the anecdotal deciphering of the initials of the Soviet Bolshevik Party, VKPB, current among Moscow workers at that time as Vdoroye Krepostnoye Pravo, Bolsheviks, Second Serfdom, Bolsheviks, this did not seem to us so much funny as prophetic. They sought a new stimulus for socially useful labor. They thought originally it would be found in conscientiousness and enthusiasm, along with material disinterestedness. And that is why they seized so eagerly on the great example of the Subotniki, voluntary Saturdays. But this turned out not to be the beginning of a new era, but a tremor of self-sacrifice on the part of one of the last generations of the revolution. It can be seen, for example, from provincial materials in Tambov, that in 1921 many members of the party were already trying to get out of the Subotniki, and a mark was introduced in the party record book for participation in Subotniki. Yes, this outburst lasted another decade, enough for the Komsomols and us, the young pioneers of those times. But then it came to an end for us, too. And what was next? Where was the stimulus to be sought? Money? Peace rates? Bonus payments? But all of that carried the acrid smell of recent capitalism, and a long period was required, another generation, for that smell to cease to irritate, so it could be peaceably accepted as the socialist principle of material incentive. They dug down deeper into the storage chest of history and dragged out what Marx had called extra-economic coercion. In camp and on collective farms, this discovery was presented with bared fangs. And then Frenkel came along, and, like a devil sprinkling a poison potion into the boiling cauldron, he poured in the differentiated ration pot. There was a famous incantation repeated over and over again. In the new social structure there can be no place for the discipline of the stick on which serfdom was based, nor the discipline of starvation on which capitalism is based. And there you are. The archipelago managed miraculously to combine the one and the other. All in all, the particular techniques required for this totaled three. One, the differentiated ration pot. Two, the brigade. And three, two sets of bosses. But the third of these was not absolutely necessary. At Vorkuta, for example, there was only one set of bosses, and things hummed. And so it was that the archipelago rested on these three whales, these three pillars, or, if one considers them the driving belts, they certainly made the wheels turn. We have already explained about the differentiated ration pot. This was a redistribution of bread and cereals aimed at making our Zek beat his head against the wall and break his back for the average prisoner's ration, which in parasitical societies is issued to an inactive prisoner. To fix it so that our Zek could get his own lawful ration only in extra dollops of 3.5 ounces and by being considered a shock worker. Percentages of output above 100 conferred the right to supplementary spoonfuls of kasha, those previously taken away. What a merciless knowledge of human nature! Neither those pieces of bread nor those cereal patties were comparable with the expenditure of strength that went into earning them. But as one of his eternal disastrous traits, the human being is incapable of grasping the ratio of an object to its price. For a cheap glass of vodka, a soldier is roused to attack in a war not his own and lays down his life. In the same way, the Zek, for those paupers' handouts, slips off a log, gets dunked in the icy freshet of a northern river, or kneads clay for mud huts barefoot in icy water, and because of this those feet are never going to reach the land of freedom. However, the satanical differentiated ration pot was not all-powerful. Not everyone took the bait. just as serfs at one time or another grasped the truth that you may have to eat less, but at least you won't have to break your back working. So the Zeks, too, understood. In camp, it was not the small ration that killed people, but the big one. Lazy, stupid, insensible half-animals. They don't want that supplementary allotment of rations. They don't want a piece of that nourishing bread made from a mix of potatoes, vetch, and water. They don't want to be released ahead of term. They don't even want to be posted on the Board of Honor. They don't want to rise to the interests of the construction project in the country. They don't want to fulfill the five-year plans, even though the five-year plans are in the interests of the workers. They wander about the nooks and crannies of the mines on the floors of construction projects, and they are delighted to hide from the rain in a dark hole, just anything, in order not to work. Not often is it possible to arrange such mass labor projects as in the gravel pit near Yaroslavl. There, hundreds of prisoners are clumped together in a small area visible to the naked eyes of the supervisors, and hardly has any one of them stopped moving than he is immediately conspicuous. These are ideal conditions. No one even dares to slow down, to straighten his back, to wipe off the sweat, until up on the hill the flag drops, the signal for a smoking period. How, then, is it to be managed in other cases? Much thought was applied, and the brigade was invented. Yes, and for that matter, how could we fail to invent it? In our country, even the Narodniki, the populists, wanted to enter into socialism through the Obshchina, the peasant commune, and the Marxists through the collective. And what do our newspapers write even nowadays? The main thing for a human being is work, and it must be work in a collective. And in camp, there is nothing but work, and only in a collective. Does that mean that the corrective labor camp is the highest goal of humanity? That the main thing has been attained? How the brigade serves the psychological enrichment of its members, the prodding, the surveillance, and the heightened sense of dignity, we have already had cause to explain in Chapter 3. Consistent with the purposes of the brigade, worthy tasks and brigadiers, known in camp lingo as bugri, in other words, lumps, are selected. Slave driving the prisoners with club and ration. The brigadier has to cope with the brigade in the absence of the higher-ups, the supervisors, and the convoy. Shalamov cites examples in which the whole membership of the brigade died several times over in the course of one gold-washing season on the Kolyma, but the brigadier remained the same. That was the kind of brigadier Perelamov was in Kermelag. He did not use his tongue, merely his stave. The list of these names would take up many pages here, but I have not compiled it. It is of interest that this kind of brigadier most often came from the thieves, that is, from the lumpen proletariat. However, what is there to which people cannot adapt? It would be crude on our part not to look closely and observe how the brigade sometimes became a natural constituent cell of the native society of the archipelago, of the same kind that the family is in freedom. I myself knew such brigades, and more than one, too. True, these were not brigades on general work, where someone had to die because otherwise the rest could not survive. These were usually special brigades, electricians, lathe operators, carpenters, painters. The fewer their members, some 10 or 12 persons, the more clearly the principle of mutual protection and mutual support appeared in them. This was manifested, too, in big brigades made up of various trades, but only in the hard labor camps and under special conditions. More about this in Part 5. For such a brigade, and for such a role, there also had to be a suitable brigadier. Moderately hard, well acquainted with all the moral, immoral, laws of Gulag, perspicacious and fair within the brigade, with his own well-worked-out method of coping with the higher-ups, whether it be a hoarse bark or a quiet and underhanded approach. He had to be feared by all the trustees and let no opportunity go by to grab off for the brigade an extra 3.5 ounces, padded trousers, a pair of shoes. But he also had to have connections among the influential trustees, from whom he could learn all the camp news and impending changes. He needed this for correct leadership. He had to know the work well and the sectors which were advantageous and disadvantageous, and be adept at shoving the neighbouring brigade, if there was a neighbouring brigade, onto the disadvantageous sectors. With a sharp eye out for the chances of tuchta, and sensing where best to grab it off within a particular 5-day work period, whether through manipulating work norms or total volume, and defend this unwaveringly against the work assigner, when the latter was already waiting with splattering fountain pen to cut back the worksheets, and adroit at greasing the paw of the norm setter, and knowing who in his brigade was a stoolie, and if this stoolie was not very smart or malicious, then leaving him alone, since otherwise they'd send in a worse one. And he always had to know whom in the brigade he should encourage with a glance, and whom to curse out, and to whom to give a lighter job that particular day. And a brigade like that, with a brigadier like that, adapts itself to austerity and survives austerely. There is no tenderness here, but no one dies. I worked with brigadiers like that, with Sinebryakov and Pavel Boronyuk. And if I were to compile a list of others like them, it would be many pages long. And on the basis of many different stories, there is a consensus that such efficient and intelligent brigadiers most often originated from among the Kulak sons. But what was there to do? If they implacably forced the brigade on the Zeks as a form of existence, then what was to be done? It was necessary somehow to adapt to it, was it not? We will die from the work, but we are able to survive only by working. Of course, this is a questionable philosophy. A better answer would be, don't teach me to die the way you want, but let me die the way I want. But they won't allow you to anyway. That's what... And the choice, facing the brigadier, could be difficult also. If the logging brigade failed to fulfill the day's norm of 72 cubic yards, the brigadier went into the punishment block too. And if you don't want to go to the punishment block, then drive your brigade members to their deaths. Bow down to the stronger. And the two sets of bosses were also convenient, in just the same way that pliers need both a right and left jaw. Two bosses. These were the hammer and the anvil, and they hammered out of the Zek what the state required, and when he broke, they brushed him into the garbage bin. Even though the maintenance of a separate administration for the camp compound greatly increased the state's expenditures, and even if out of stupidity, caprice, and vigilance it often complicated the working process, nevertheless they put it there anyway, and this was no mistake. Two bosses. This was two tormentors instead of one, in shifts too, and placed in a situation of competition to see who could squeeze more out of the prisoner and give him less. Production, materials, tools, transportation were in the hands of one boss. All that was lacking was manpower. This manpower was brought in every morning by the convoy from the camp and taken away to the camp every evening, or in shifts. During those 10 or 12 hours during which the Zeks were in the hands of the production bosses, there was no need to educate them or correct them, and even if they dropped dead during the course of the workday, this wouldn't disappoint either administration. Corpses could be written off more easily than burned-up boards or stolen linseed oil. It was important for the production bosses to compel the prisoners to do more work in a day and to credit them with less in their worksheets, because it was necessary to make up somehow for all the fatal over-expenditures and shortages on the production side, because the trusts were engaged in stealing, and so were the construction and installation administration, and the construction superintendents, and the foremen, and the worksite superintendents, and the truck drivers, and the Zeks least of all, and then not for themselves, for they had nowhere to take the stuff, but for their camp chiefs and their convoy. And still more than all of that put together was lost through careless and negligent management, and also because the Zeks didn't take good care of anything either, and there was just one way to make up for all these shortages: underpayment for manpower. The camp administration, on the other hand, controlled the workforce alone. Rabsila. The tongue certainly knows how to abbreviate. But this was the decisive factor. The camp chiefs, in fact, used to say, "We can squeeze them, the production administration, because they can't find other workers anywhere else. Where could you find manpower in the taiga and the desert?" Consequently, they sought to squeeze more money out in return for the Rabsila, which in part was turned over to the government, but in part went for the maintenance of the camp administration itself, in return for its guarding the Zeks from freedom, providing them with food and drink, dressing them, and morally harassing them. Just as always in our well-thought-out social system, two different plans collided head-on here too. The production plan, whose objective was to have the lowest possible expenditures for wages, and the MVD plan, whose objective was to extract the largest possible earnings from camp production. To an observer on the sidelines, it seems strange why set one's own plans in conflict with one another. Oh, but there is a profound meaning in it. Conflicting plans flatten the human being. This is a principle which far transcends the barbed wire of the archipelago. And what is also important is that these two sets of bosses are by no means hostile to each other, as one might think from their constant squabbles and mutual deceits. Where it is necessary to flatten someone thoroughly, they close ranks very tightly. And even though the camp chief is the Zek's dear father, yet he always willingly recognizes and signs an official affidavit that the Zek himself was to blame for his own injury, and not the contractor. He will not be very insistent on the Zek's having work clothes, nor demand ventilation in some section of a plant where there is none. Well, if there isn't, there isn't. And what can you do? These are temporary difficulties. And what about the siege of Leningrad? The camp chief will never refuse the production boss when he is asked to jail a brigadier in the punishment block for rudeness, or a worker for having lost a shovel, or an engineer who hasn't carried out an order the way he should have. Didn't both these chiefs constitute the cream of society in remote settlements? Were they not the serf holders of taiga industry? And didn't their wives call on one another? If, nonetheless, there is incessant tukta in padded worksheets, if there is a constant attestation to trenches dug and filled which never yawned in the earth's surface, repair of heating systems or lathes which were never out of order, replacement of perfectly sturdy posts, which will still be standing there for another 10 years, then this is done not at the instigation of the camp chiefs, who are quite calm and confident that the money will flow to the camp one way or another anyway, but by Zeks themselves, brigadiers, norm-setters, foremen. Because all state work norms are the same. They are calculated not for real life on this earth, but for some kind of unearthly ideal on the moon. A human being dedicated, self-sacrificing, healthy, well-nourished and energetic is incapable of fulfilling those norms. And so what are you going to get out of a fagged-out, weak, hungry and downtrodden convict? The state system of setting work norms prescribes an output impossible on this planet, and in this sense resembles socialist realism and belles lettres. But if the unsold books are easily shredded later, it is more complicated to cover up industrial tukta. However, it is not impossible. In their constant tail-chasing haste, the director and the construction superintendent have, let's say, overlooked or missed, noticing, failed to discover the tukta. And the free foremen were either illiterate or drunk, or else well-disposed to the Zeks, with the expectation, of course, that in a difficult moment the Zek brigadier would help them out. And by then the percentage bonus had been eaten up, and you couldn't pull the bread back out of the belly. Accountants' inspections and audits are notorious for their clumsiness. They turn up tukta after a delay of months or years, when the money paid out for the work has long since flitted away, and all that can still be done is to bring charges against one of the free employees, or else smudge it up and write it off. Three pillars on which the archipelago is propped were set there by the leadership. the differentiated ration pot, the work brigade, and the two sets of bosses. And the fourth and main pillar was Tukta, and it was put there by the archipelago natives and by life itself. For Tukta, it is essential to have energetic, enterprising brigadiers, but production chiefs from among the Zeks are even more necessary. No few of them were foremen, norm-setters, planners, economists, because you just wouldn't drag free people off to those distant places. Some Zeks in those positions forgot who they were, became more cruel than free workers, trampled on their brother prisoners, and made their way over dead bodies to their own release ahead of term. Others, on the contrary, retained a distinct consciousness of their motherland, the archipelago, and introduced reasonable moderation in the management of production and a reasonable share of Tukta in their accounting. There was a risk for them in this, not the risk of getting a new term, because the terms were already piled high anyway and their code articles were harsh, but the risk of losing their position, angering the chiefs, landing in a bad prisoner transport, and thus perishing silently. And therefore their staunchness and intelligence were all the more glorious in that they helped their brothers to survive. Vasily Grigorievich Vlasov, for example, whose acquaintance we have already made in connection with the Kadi trial, was that kind of person. Throughout his whole long sentence, he served 19 years without any interruption, he retained that same stubborn self-assurance which characterized his conduct during the trial, and with which he had mocked Kalinin and the commutation of his death sentence. Through all these years, when he was dried up from starvation and breaking his back on general work, he perceived himself not as a scapegoat, but as a genuine political prisoner, and even as a revolutionary, as he used to describe himself in heart-to-heart conversations. And when, thanks to his naturally sharp administrative grasp, which in his case substituted for his incomplete schooling in economics, he held jobs as a trustee in production posts, Vlasov sought not only to postpone his own death, but also the chance to patch up the whole cart, so it was easier for the rest of the fellows to pull it along. In the '40s, on one of the Ust-Vim logging camp sites, and Ust-Vim Lag was distinct from the general pattern in that it had only one unified set of bosses. The camp itself ran its logging, did its own auditing, and was responsible for plan fulfillment to the Ministry of the Timber Industry. Vlasov simultaneously combined the duties of norm-setter and planner. He was the head of the whole thing there, and in winter, in order to provide support for the sloggers out logging, he credited their brigades with fictitious cubic yards of wood cut. One of the winters was particularly severe, and working just as hard as they could, the Zeks fulfilled the work norms by only 60%, but received rations for having fulfilled 125% of norm. And with the help of these beefed-up rations, they managed to last out the winter without halting work even one day. However, shipments of the felled, on paper, timber, were far behind schedule, and the camp chief heard some evil rumors. In March, he sent a commission of 4 men into the woods, and they turned up a shortage of 10,500 cubic yards of timber. The enraged chief summoned Vlasov, who heard him out, and then said to him, "Give 'em, chief, 5 days in the brig. They're all sluts. They were too lazy to get out into the woods because the snow there is still deep. Set up a new commission with me as the chairman." And thereupon, with his own sensible troika, Vlasov, without leaving his office, drew up an official document and found all the missing timber. The chief was quieted down for the time being, but in May there was more trouble. They were still shipping out too little timber, and the higher-ups kept asking questions. So the chief called in Vlasov again. Vlasov was a short fellow, but he always retained his vigorous, rooster-like bearing, and this time he didn't even pretend. The timber just didn't exist. "So how could you have drawn up a false document, blankety blank blank blank?" Vlasov replied, "Do you think it would have been better for you to go to jail yourself? After all, 10,500 cubic yards is a full 10-ruble bill for a free employee, and even for a Czechist, it's a fiver." The chief cursed him out, but by this time it was too late to punish Vlasov. The whole thing depended on him. Well, what's to be done now? Vlasov answered, just wait till the roads have completely dissolved in mud. And the time came when the winter roads had all dissolved completely, and the summer logging trails were still impassable too. And at this point, Vlasov brought the chief a detailed and watertight report for his signature to be sent on to the administration higher up. In it, he proved that because of the highly successful timber felling operations of the past winter, it had been quite impossible to move 10,500 cubic yards out of the forests on the sledge trails. Neither could this timber be hauled out through the swampy forests. Next, he gave estimates for the cost of a corduroy road to get the timber out, and he proved that the haulage would cost more than the timber was worth. So that, in a year's time, because the logs were going to be lying there in the swamp for a whole summer and autumn, they would be unsuitable for lumber, and acceptable to any possible customer only for firewood. And the administration agreed with these literate conclusions, which they were not ashamed to show any other commission. And therefore the whole 10,500 cubic yards of timber were written off. And so it was that the trees were felled and eaten up and written off, and stood once again erect and proud in their green coniferous garb. And in fact the state paid very reasonably for these dead cubic yards, a few hundred extra loaves of black, gluey, watery bread. The thousands of trees and the hundreds of lives which were saved were of no account on the profit and loss sheet, because this kind of wealth was never counted in the archipelago. In all probability, Vlasov was not the only one who had been so perspicacious as to play the swindler, because from 1947 on they introduced a new system in all logging operations, complex work gangs and complex work brigades. And now the lumberjacks were combined with the teamsters in one work gang, and the brigade was only credited with timber hauled out to the slide on the riverbank to the site of the spring log drive. And so, what happened then? Did this burst the balloon of the Tukhta? Hardly. It even flourished. It expanded out of necessity, and the mass of workers nourished on it grew larger and larger. For those among our readers who are not bored with this, let's go into it more deeply. 1. The Zeks were not permitted to accompany the logs farther than the slide on the river bank. Who would convoy them down the river? Vigilance. Therefore, an expediter of the log rafting office, which was staffed with free lumberjacks, accepted the timber from the camp dispatcher, for all the brigades, at the river. Well, now, he, of course, was strict in his receipts. Not at all. The camp dispatcher would inflate the figures as much as he had to on behalf of the logging brigades, and the expediter of the log rafting office was agreeable to the whole deal. 2. And here is why. The log rafting office also had the problem of feeding its own free workers, and their work norms were equally impossible. And the log rafting office listed all of this non-existent fictitious timber as having been rafted downriver. 3. At the general landing and sorting point downriver, where the timber was collected from all the logging sectors, there was a bourse, which was a landing area for logs. Here again, Zeks were doing the work, attached to that self-same Ustvimlag. The 52 islands of Ustvimlag were scattered over a territory 96 miles square. Now that is what our archipelago is like. The dispatcher of the log rafting office was quite at ease. The camp expediter would now accept back all the Tukhta, in the second place so as not to betray his own camp, which had previously delivered it to the slide, and in the first place so as to feed its own prisoners working at the landing point with that same fictitious timber. They, too, had their own fantastic work norms, and they needed their crust, too. At this point, however, the camp expediter had to toil a bit for the sake of society. He not only had to accept the timber by total volume, but also list it, existing and fictitious, by diameters and lengths in a complete schedule. Now here was a benefactor for you. Vlasov worked at this job too. 4. After the bourse came the sawmill, which processed the logs into cut lumber. Once more, the workers were Zeks. The brigades were given rations on the basis of their volume of raw timber processed, and the extra fictitious timber was just exactly what they needed in order to increase their own percentage output. 5. Next came the lumber yard for the completed product, which was required, according to state norms, to have 65% of the amount of raw timber received by the sawmill. Thus it was that 65% of the fictitious timber moved invisibly into the lumber yard, and the mythical lumber was likewise inventoried by sorts, wavy-edged slab, construction lumber, by thickness of board, edged, unedged. The lumberyard workers, too, got their food out of that same fictitious timber. But what happened then? The fictitious lumber was shut up in the lumberyard, where it was guarded by the camp guard, and there could not be any more uncontrolled losses. And who at this point was going to answer for the tuchter, and how? At this point, another great principle of the archipelago came to the aid of the principle of tuchter. This was the principle of rubber, in other words, stretching things out with interminable delays. Once on the books, the fictitious production kept being carried over from one year to another. Whenever there was inventory taking in this wild archipelago backwards, all those engaged in it were, after all, friends, and all understood. You wouldn't go around moving every board in the place just for the sake of the audit. Unfortunately, a certain percentage of fictitious lumber could spoil from being kept too long, and could be written off. And they would fire one manager of the lumberyard, and then another, and put them to work as work norm setters. And how many people had been fed in the meanwhile? Here is what they tried to do, too. When they loaded lumber into railroad cars for shipment to buyers, there was no customer expediter up there, and the railroad cars would subsequently be scattered all over the country on the basis of bills of lading. They tried similarly to ship the fictitious lumber as well, in other words, to inflate the amount shipped, and this fed the stevedore brigades, let's note. The railroad put a seal on the car. It couldn't care less. After a certain length of time, somewhere in Armavir or Krivoy Rog, they would break the seal on the car and open it up and document the amount actually received. If the underweight was moderate, then all these differences in volume would be collected in some schedule or other, and it would be up to the State Planning Commission to account for them. If the underweight was outrageous, the recipient would send a claim to Ustvimlag, but these claims moved in a flood of millions of other papers, and was stapled in a file somewhere, and in time simply went out like a light. After all, they simply could not stand up against people's pressure to live. And no one was going to send the carload of lumber back from Armavir. You took what you got. There was no timber in the south. Now let us note the fact that the state and the Ministry of the Timber Industry made serious use in their economic reports of these fictitiously inflated figures for the production of cut and processed timber. They were useful to the ministry too. And this is how tuchta, like many of the archipelago's problems, could not be kept confined to it, but acquired a nationwide significance. But probably the most surprising thing was this. It would seem that there should have been a shortage of timber because of the fictitious inflation of quantities at every stage of its movement. However, the fact was that the expediter at the landing Bourse managed to add so much fictitious timber to deliveries in the course of the summer season that by fall the timber rafting office had surpluses waiting in the water. They had not been touched, and they must not be left in the river for the winter, because if they were, it would be necessary in the spring to call in a plane to bomb them loose. And therefore this surplus timber, which no one needed, was allowed in late autumn to float downstream into the White Sea. Is that miraculous, strange, and wonderful? But it didn't just happen in one place. At the lumber yards in Unzhlag, there was always surplus lumber left over, which hadn't been loaded into railroad cars, and which was no longer listed as belonging to anyone anywhere. And for years after some lumber yard had been totally shut down, people would subsequently journey to it from nearby camps for ownerless dry firewood, and burn in their stoves the stripped pit props which had taken so much suffering to produce. And all this was a matter of attempting to survive, not to enrich oneself, and certainly not to plunder the state. The state cannot be so excessively fierce and force its subjects into deceit. And here is what the prisoners used to say. Without Tukta and Ammonau, never could we have built the canal. So all that is what the archipelago stands on. Chapter 6. They've brought the fascists. They've brought the fascists! They've brought the fascists! The young Czech lads and girls shouted excitedly, running through the camp when our two trucks, each loaded with 30 fascists, entered the perimeter of the small rectangle of the Novo Jerusalem camp. We had just experienced one of the supreme hours of our life, the 1 hour's drive from Moscow's Krasnaya Preznia prison, what is called a short-distance prisoner transport. Though we had spent the ride with our knees hunched up in the rear of the trucks, nonetheless all the air, the speed, the colours were ours. Oh, forgotten brightness of the world! The streetcars were red, the trolleybuses sky blue, the crowd in white and many-coloured. Do they themselves see these colours as they crowd onto the buses? And on top of this today, for some reason, all the buildings and the lampposts were decorated with banners and streamers. Some sort of unexpected holiday. August the 14th, coinciding with the holiday of our liberation from prison. On this day, the capitulation of Japan had been announced, ending the 7-day war. On the Volokolamsk highway, a whirlwind of scents of new-mown hay and of the early evening freshness of the meadows swirled around our shaven heads. This meadow breeze, who could breathe it in more greedily than prisoners? Real, genuine green blinded our eyes, grown used to grey and more grey. I turned up on the transport with Gamarov and Ingal, and we sat next to each other, and it seemed to us as if we were going to a gay dacha, a country house. The end of such a bewitching journey could not be something dismal. And then we jumped from the trucks, stretched our numbed legs and backs, and looked around. We liked the compound of Novi Jerusalem. It was even attractive. It was surrounded not by a solid fence, but merely by an interwoven barbed wire fence. And in every direction were visible the hilly, lively village and dacha countryside of the Svenigorod land. It was as if we were part of that gay milieu. We could see the earth just like those who came here to rest and enjoy themselves, and we could even see it on a larger, deeper scale, for our eyes had grown used to flat walls, flat sleeping boards, and shallow cells. And to us it seemed even more succulent. The greenery, which had faded by mid-August, blinded us, and perhaps, too, it seemed to have so much succulence because the sun was setting. "So you are the fascists? Are all of you fascists?" the approaching Czechs asked us hopefully. And having confirmed that yes, we were the fascists, they immediately scurried off and left the scene. There was nothing else about us that interested them. We already knew, of course, that the fascists was a nickname for the 58s, introduced by the sharp-eyed thieves and very much approved by the chiefs. Previously, they had well named the 58s KRs, but then all that had grown stale, and a catchy label was needed. After our swift trip in the fresh air, here it seemed warmer, and because of that, cozier. We were still looking around the tiny compound with its two-story building of brick for men, and the women's building, which was wooden with an attic story, and some peasant-style tumble-down sheds for auxiliary services. And then of the long black shadows which lay everywhere in the fields, cast by the trees and the buildings, and at the high chimney of the brickyard, and at the already flaming windows of its two buildings. "Well, things aren't so bad here, it seems," we spoke to one another, trying to convince each other and ourselves. One young fellow with that sharply alert and hostile expression, which we had already begun to notice in others, lingered near us longer than the rest, inspecting the fascists with interest. His well-worn black cap set crookedly forward on his forehead. He kept his hands in his pockets, and he stood there just like that, listening to our chatter. Not bad. His chest shook. Twisting his lips, he looked us over contemptuously once again and hurled out, Starvation Station, you'll kick the bucket. And spitting under our feet, he went out. He found it unbearable to listen any longer to such idiots. Our hearts fell. The first night in camp, you are already being borne along a slippery slide, down, and somewhere there must be still a saving, protruding ledge, which you have to catch hold of, but you don't know where it is. Everything that was worst in your entire upbringing has come alive inside you. Everything suspicious, gloomy, grasping, cruel, instilled there by hungry cues, by the blatant injustice of the strong. This worst in you has been even more aroused, even more stirred up inside you, by the preceding rumors about the camps. Just don't get put on general work. The wolfish camp world. Here they tear you to pieces alive. Here they stomp on he who has stumbled. Just don't go on general work. But how can you avoid it? Which way is one to flee? One has to give something. One has to give to someone. But what in particular? And to whom? And how is it done? Not an hour has gone by, and a fellow aboard our same transport comes up with a restrained smile. He has been named a construction engineer in the camp compound. And one more. He has been given permission to open a barber shop for the free workers at the factory. And yet another. He ran into an old acquaintance, and he is going to go to work in the planning section. Your heart winces. All this is skin off your back. They will survive in the offices and the barber shops, and you will perish. Perish. The compound. 200 paces from barbed wire to barbed wire, and you can't go close to it either. Yes, all around you the Svenigorod hills will gleam green, but in here is a starvation mess hall, and a stone dungeon for a penalty isolator, and a miserable lean-to over a burner for individual cooking, a rotten shed of a bath, a grey booth of a tumble-down latrine with rotting seats, and nowhere to hide from it. This was it. Perhaps this little island would be the last piece of earth in your life which your feet were destined to tromp on. In all the rooms, bare multiple bunks, vagonki, were installed. The multiple bunk was the invention of the archipelago, an adaptation for the sleep of the natives never encountered anywhere else in the world. Two stories of four wooden panels on two cross-shaped supports, placed at the head and at the feet. When one sleeper stirred, three others rocked. They did not issue mattresses in this camp, nor sacks to stuff with straw. The words bed linen were unknown to the natives of the Novi Jerusalem island. No sheets or pillowcases existed here, and they did not issue or launder underwear. You had what you wore, and you had to look after it yourself. And the manager of camp property had never heard the word pillow. The only pillows were those you owned, and were had only by women and thieves. In the evening, when you lay down on the naked panel, you could take off your shoes, but take into consideration that your shoes would be swiped. Better sleep with shoes on. Better not scatter your clothes about either. They'd swipe them, too. On going out to work in the morning, you must not leave anything in the barracks. Whatever the thieves did not bother to take, the jailers would, announcing, It's forbidden! In the morning you would go out to work just as nomads depart from a campsite, leaving it even cleaner. You would leave neither the ashes from your bonfires nor the bones of devoured animals. The room would be empty, totally bare, and you could even turn it over for others to occupy. And your own sleeping panel would have nothing to distinguish it from all the others, bare, greasy, polished by bodies. But you couldn't cart anything off to work with you either. You would gather up your chattels in the morning, stand in line at the storeroom for personal belongings, and hide them in a bag or a suitcase. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.